Hi, and welcome to this VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are going to the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. These titles get longer and longer each time. But anyway, joined as we hopefully are always joined by Matt Wallen and Jason Diamond. Matt, how are you?
I'm great.
And Jason, how's New York?
I'm great, and happy Father's Day to all of you who celebrate. It is a American Father's Day right now, but nonetheless, happy.
Us non-American fathers will take happiness in that anyway. Hey, I find the names of these films kind of weird, right? Like Beyond the Planet of the Kingdom of the Apes, where they were used to be, whatever. There are a lot of these Planet of the Apes movies. I don't even know what metric we should judge them by. Like, I know for me personally, the original Planet of the Apes, I'm talking Charlton Heston, God damn it, mm-hmm. I can't believe you did it kind of thing, was a significant film for me when I was growing up, right? It was like a film that I thought was really cool. I thought it was really exciting. It was, a very breathtakingly interesting thing. I was less interested in some of the remakes that happened in the middle and then got interested again when they started doing them with Weta. And there was obviously a trilogy of those around Caesar. And now we have this one by Wes Ball. So I guess, Matt, starting with you, like, how do you judge this just as a film, and how do you judge it in the pantheon of apes films?
I mean, I think as a movie, just standalone without any of the sort of legacy. I mean, I don't know if you could watch it without knowing the premise, right? I mean, I guess they allude to it. You could watch it, I suppose. But I think as one of the apes movies, there are some things about it that I think from an effects standpoint are really interesting. And I think it's the most sophisticated visual effects apes film, in my opinion. I think it crosses into some new territory. So from a visual effects standpoint, I would say this is the movie to beat this year in terms of your visual effects in your any projects that people are working on. I mean, this is really top shelf work. There's one or two little things that I could quibble with, and we can get to those later. But the whole Apes franchise, I think, is pretty fun. It comes from, if I'm not mistaken, I think originally a Twilight Zone story, a Rod Serling. I don't know if he wrote it, but they did a version of a kind of Planet of the Apes thing, and then it became a series of movies, and then there was a TV show in the 70s, and I was so into the TV show as a kid. And I remember one time my dad walking in while I was watching it, and I was probably like, 10, and he just went, "Oh, ish." which is a Midwestern expression of like disgust, or actually I think it's maybe Scandinavian or something, ish kabibble or something like that. But I always loved it. I thought it was so much fun. And I think the premise is so neat. And what's great about this film in particular, I think, which we can get into more deeply, is how incredible the acting and performances are that they are able to retarget onto these ape characters. It's just a whole nother level, even beyond, in my opinion, the last Avatar.
That's really interesting. The original was 1968, so like this has got to be up there with James Bond as kind of like long-running franchises.
For sure.
But you'd think with a thing like this where there is sort of like backstory that every audience would get smaller and smaller as you go along, because you always lose a few. And then other people are like, well, I'm not really into the Planet of the Apes, so I'm not going to start now kind of thing. But this film went remarkably well at the box office. Jason, why do we think this one seemed to have resonated in a period where people were really pessimistic about the outlook? In fact, this really outperformed expectations.
Yeah, I mean, just to back up a tiny bit about my thoughts on it real quick, I really enjoyed it. I went with my kid, who like binged the two Matt Reeves and the, who did the first one? I forget who did the James Franco one, the first of the previous trilogy. But Rupert,
Rise of Planet of the Apes, you mean?
Yeah, is that, yeah, the first one of the trilogy.
Yeah, Rise of the Planet of the Apes was Robert Wyatt, I'm gonna say.
Rupert Wyatt,
Rupert Wyatt. There you go. Yep. Sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you,
man. Yep. And then Matt Reeves, I think took them and ran in an incredible direction, both filmmaking wise, because he's a great director, but also technologically, him and Weta really, I think, went, you know, deep into the archives to pull out some amazing tech, which I believe we've spoken about in the past, and have, I think some of it was initially for the Avatar sequels that got shelved, and it kind of got, shoved into the ape stuff with forests and water and stuff. I think, and as we always say, the script, you know, the effects are one thing, but the script and the enjoyability of the story is the key. And in this one, I really enjoyed the story. Like, it's hard to find new stories, I think, in the apes verse, given all the ones in the 60s and 70s where they kind of went kooky with all the, you know, robots and kind of, which I love. It's a cool thing.
Worshipping the atomic bomb.
And yeah, stuff. The atomic bombs and yeah. stuff. Was,
oh, like, I don't know. It lost me at Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
I love them. But I mean, because it's just like at that.
Yeah, but that was in an age of like, we're going to just milk a franchise and every sequel has a smaller budget than the one before it.
But because they don't have the technology to engage you with the story on that level, like we can get better and better apes now to get better and better performances, to Matt's point, they went for plot devices instead of, you know, they're like, we got the apes down, we can do the masks, everybody bought it, we're cool, they look great, we got to go story. In this case, they have technology to, and everyone's racing to make better and better technology that allows them to do things beyond story. But of course, it's all beholden to story. And in this one, I really appreciated the sort of pseudo religious approach where they're basically kind of saying, this is how myth, and myth is ultimately religion to a certain extent. No, I'm not knocking on religion. I'm just saying they're all based on myths and stories and things that people over time haven't seen or been around for. And I like, similar to like Station 11 and other things we've talked about, where you're able to show that, again, in a non-denominational, not knocking religion way, but to show the structure of story and how it impacts civilization and things like that. And as always, was it Maurice or the orangutan character steals the show, as always, and as has in the previous movies and continues to do in this movie.
Different I'm excited for Wes's time, but I can't remember what his name was.
Well, he says he was been around since Caesar, so I think it's supposed to be the same dude, but
I don't think so. I don't think that's
true. But
yeah, I agree.
But anyway, I'm excited for Wes's new trilogy. And to your point, I think all of those things combined is what made people connect with it and made people excited about it in the theater. Why that didn't translate to other movies like Fall Guy or other things that we've talked about, I don't know. And there's little zeitgeisty things that happen. But, you know, I'm happy that this movie did well for multiple reasons, for Wes, for the franchise, for other things. But I think people are connecting with it.
Yeah, I mean, they are. Yeah. I mean, I completely lost track of any caring about it when they went into Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And then they went, I think you mentioned, Matt, the TV show, like they made movies out of the TV show. They take episodes and repackage them. I think there was one that was called Farewell to Planet of the Apes, where apes were basically feeding humans to sharks until they discovered how to make hang gliders. I mean, it was just bizarre. Like,
I love
it. And I don't even know which one you're referring to with worshiping the robots. That's not, I don't even want to see that. And yet, I totally agree with you. Like, the tech that Weta pioneered, and also not just the tech in like motion capture, and obviously that was spectacular, but the rendering tech to be able to produce the quality of the fur and the imagery. And having those performances, I mean, obviously the big one was Caesar in the previous trilogy, which was spectacular kind of acting.
Yeah.
But also Caesar's, what's the name of the guy? The right-hand man of Caesar that was the sort of semi-evil guy.
I can't remember his name.
And there was a sequence in that, in one of the earlier ones, where he came and found two humans and pretended to be a stupid ape so as to disarm them so as to overpower them. And I remember so distinctly thinking, you've really reached this high watermark in acting for digital characters when we as the audience can understand that a digital character has an internal monologue that requires them to act in a way that isn't the way they actually are, and that we can understand that they're only doing that to fake out some other people while still reading their intent through that mask of the charade of being stupid. It was like a classic
case. That was the machine gun sequence,
And it was like subtext, and it was, I'm going to say his name was Congo, but that's all right. I'll think of it in a second. And it was just spectacular.
Koba,
that's it. And it was, with a K, right? And it was just such nuanced acting. And it wasn't just translating the actor's face. I think some of the Caesar stuff got a little bit like that, where you felt like you were actually looking at, you know, the actual actor now morphing the face of Caesar a bit to match the actor of Andy Serkis. Whereas in the case of that sequence with the machine gun, it was just it was a combination of everything, right? Had to be good motion capture or performance capture, but obviously it wasn't just performance capture that translated, that let the audience read what was going on and no point be confused of what was happening or whatever. It was just, you know, you were just 100% as valid as any good actor, albeit through that digital process. Interestingly, I think you might've touched on this in a sense in this film. I don't know that the best, like I liked the film obviously, and I liked everything about how it was done, but there were other characters other than the lead characters that I thought were spectacularly good. And one of them I'm going to call out because it was relatively minor was the mother ape. When he reunites with her at the camp, you know, where the dam effectively is in the third act, the mother appears, you totally know who she is. Her performance is really great. She's not a major central character to the whole plot, yet she has, you have no difficulty understanding her gender, her background, what she's thinking, like her emotions. It was just, I don't know, just mic-droppingly good for me. It was like when those background characters are that good, as opposed to just kind of filling in the spots, you really know you've got depth to the VFX team.
I mean, I think you'd say the same when he meets his other two friends, right? Because they're not with him either in the camp. He sees them in the camp in different. He meets one, then he meets the other, then he meets the mom.
Like we've seen them in that opening sequence with the eel's egg, and they're clearly going to be playing a big role in the subsequent last part of the performance. It's the, I guess I'm just saying, like the mother, you know. Let's say you're the artist given the mother, like how many pages has she got? Like she's got to be some at the camp, some back at the reunion, but it's not like she's got a lot of dialogue, whatever else. And yet she it's just one example, I think, of like a really solid, what do you call it? Yeah. A deep bench.
Yeah. Like, I mean, as a sort of a, you know, second tier character in the narrative, you know, there's the whole thing too, where she's seemingly sort of conflicted too with like, the plans when they're in the camp near the armory or whatever, where the guerrilla camp is or whatever. And she's sort of conflicted, like, you know, like, well, you know, we're okay here. We're at least we're safe. Like, yes, we have to do what they say, but, you know, and some of the subtle performance cues from the mother character that are nonverbal, I think are also really impressive. Yeah. So it's like, it's just really a rich performance, both performance of the actor, but the performance capture and the augmentation of that performance through the digital character.
Can I ask you guys a question? Like at just on plot for a second, the central point of the third act effectively is finding this book, which obviously turns out to be the satellite deciphering key. Let's leave aside whether or not satellites are still running so long into the future and that you can run power to the, you know, center by flicking a switch, suddenly there's power that works. Let's assume for a second all of that's fine. Just in terms of, I guess, audience sentiment, were you guys like team apes or team humans? Because at the end, you're kind of presented with this idea that she was part of a team to get this, to take back to a human enclave, which notionally is kind of fortified against apes. So he's helping her. In some respects, she's the enemy. In some respects, she's not. This wasn't an innocent, you know, she's May's book is like, as I say, like a key to something that's going to let them connect to more humans, and maybe that's significant on the next film. I imagine it is.
Yeah. I but sort of like that. I like that moral ambiguity kind of in the narrative. I think it's, it makes you, you know, we as the audience, I think, are predisposed in the sort of first part of the narrative. We're identifying in particular with the primary sort of the chimpanzee characters and the orangutan, right? And then the gorillas, I think, right? are the one main gorilla, sort of the heavy and right. So we're sort of in this space where we're following them. They are our proxy as the audience. And then when we start to have the humans introduced, then you're sort of reminded, if you've seen any of the other films, you're kind of reminded of the other movies and of, you know, some of the other characters in past movies who are sort of, you know, in between worlds, right? They're like friends with some of the apes, but they're also threatened by some of the other ones and also threatened by some of the other humans. So there is this kind of moral ambiguity in the narrative, in the structure of the script, I think, that it plays out pretty well, because you find yourself kind of like, oh, okay, cool. She's going to destroy all this stuff so that the bad apes can't get the tanks and the guns and whatever else. That's kind of part of their plan, because they want to make sure they can't be wiped out. But at the same time too, there's like how many of the apes are killed, you know, when everything is flooded and stuff like that, and the betrayal and the big bomb that goes off and stuff.
Were you like actively, I mean, I feel like Noah is being set up to have a really long 3-film arc, because in some respects, he's a little hard to get behind in this film. I mean, you do get behind him, obviously, and you want him to get each of the things that he sort of goes through. You don't want him to die with his father in the fire. You want him to get the eagle's egg before that. You want him to, like, you know, not be killed by the new Caesar. What's his name?
Proximus
Caesar. Caesar. Yeah, like, so. But in a certain extent, William Macy's character has a point, right? Which is like, humans kind of screwed it up, which like led to that. So kind of just accept it. And like, do humans deserve a second shot at all of this? And like, and at the end of the third, the previous trilogy, as it were, when there was that huge attack and there was the big avalanche and all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't know, I just feel like at some point you kind of go, well, humans developed the drugs that caused the problems that caused, and humans led to the, and is the world looking that bad in terms of, you know, nature regrowing over the top of buildings? And it's just sort of like,
And they say in this, like, you know, humans used to keep animals in zoos.
Yeah.
You look, stare at them, and like, you know, all these things that you're like, right, there's moral issues with that.
And also the fact that Noah isn't a natural hero in this, is he? Like, he doesn't come off as like the, I'm going to be a leader. He's probably going to be a huge leader by film 3, but in this one, he's kind of like a bit frightened. He always has a furrowed brow. Like, he's always looking like he's worried or upset or anxious in a way that you don't expect a hero to be.
The thing that's interesting is they all the chimps have broken English, right? They're not fully fluent, and the gorillas are like Proxima Caesar, because he's with William H. Macy. Spoiler alert: he speaks in full, you know, almost Shakespearean sentences, and has knowledge, and he calls on you know, Macy to tell me a story of the Roman battles, you know. But I thought it was interesting that they called, I guess she ended up being called May, but they called her Nova, which is the name of the female character in the very first Charlton Heston one, who doesn't speak. And that's why she doesn't speak in the Nova sense. And then she's like, surprise, you know, I've been playing along the whole time. I think there was an interesting, and I don't know if you picked up on this, it felt like they were teasing there was some sort of time travel element.
Oh, really?
When they were talking about, or maybe it was something my kid told me, but I can't remember. There was, because she kept saying about like, what's behind the door and how did you get here? And, you know, she's fully fluent in English and, you know, I think it's
But I just
not
assumed that she'd come from the camp we see at the end, that she was on a
mission.
Yeah,
yeah, no, at the end. I'm saying while they're trying to tease what's behind the door.
Oh, okay.
She never really says what's, but she's like, oh, it's a thing that can, I don't know, maybe I was just reading rumors before I saw the movie. I can't remember which.
Well, I think it's
first,
you know, part of it is like it's sort of ambiguous too, because she's wearing, you know, contemporary clothing, and the other humans are sort of like, you know, they just walked out of Burning Man or something. You know, like she just looks so much more like, you know, of our world, like a contemporary human. And I thought it was great too. Yeah, the Nova thing was cool, but also she's got really blue eyes, right? And that's the nickname they give to the Charlton Heston character in the original.
So I thought the whole Nova thing was to trick us old buggers who'd seen the original 68 film of just thinking that we knew, like it was giving us all this information that made us think we knew what she was going to be doing or what her capabilities would be, only to then pull the rug by saying, yeah, no, that's just a coincidence. And actually she can speak and she knows what's going on and she's on a mission.
To what you were saying about the sort of acting and performance of Noah and how he's the, you know, you really get that he's reluctant. He's a little deferential. He's sort of just problem solving along the way, learning. He's the audience in a sense in this, because we're in the future and we don't know what's happened since the last stuff with Caesar. If we switch to visual effects for a second, the thing to me that helps sell all of that stuff is the lighting, which of course ties into the rendering, but the backlighting and the edge lighting, and they've been doing this since the Matt Reeves ones, is so fucking incredible that, like, when they're the three chimps are sitting on that, I think it's in the first act, they're sitting on this little outcropping of rock and the sun's setting behind them and they're totally backlit and the camera's kind of getting a little parallax, and the way that the light hits their fur and hits the lens and hits every, just it's exactly what would happen. And it's just as narratively impactful as it would be if you were just shooting actors in, you know, in backlit sun.
So, but to build on that too, this is, I mean, it's great you dovetail into that, because it's like, I've got some notes I took right after watching it. I got in my car and I was like, oh, I got to write this down before I forget. But I think from an effects standpoint, I think this is, I know hyperbole, I think this is the film to beat this year. It's so great. They really push the technology so far. There's stuff in the opening where that opening sequence where they're getting the eggs, where you see some of like Noah and his pals, and you see them kind of from a distance, and they're navigating to get up into the tree to get where these eggs are. And there's all this wind blowing, and the wind is creating these like body hair, like rustling on the back, and it's, you see it moving through it almost like you would, like in a film where there's, you know, a big field of wheat or whatever, and you see the wind going through it.
Yeah,
but it's in these small kind of tufts and stuff, and some of that secondary kind of animation and attention to detail super heightens the realism of it. I made a note that there's a lighting thing that's similar to what you're describing, Jason, but I think it's where there's two hero apes and they're backlit by firelight, which I think happens when they're back at the village, right? Before it's attacked. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see from the side, you can see like on the chin and on the sort of the, I don't know what you call it on an ape, but like the
beard,
the muzzle, the snout kind of.
Yeah.
You see the individual hairs, and there's many of them, but that are then, you know, capturing that light, and you're getting that sort of, you know, penetration through the hair. And it's just so spectacular. Like, I remember watching that and just thinking, you know, like, this is some next level lighting and rendering. It looks so great.
Oh, for sure.
And the other one that, when you talked about lighting, the other thing that's really incredible too is the camera work. There's a handheld camera sequence in the smokehouse where they're smoking all the fish.
Oh, and yes.
There's kind of this action. It's all shot handheld. So it's very, you know, total verite. It totally fits the
The fight sequence. Scene kind of going through the pipes and everything.
Well, it's
the fight sequence.
At the beginning of the film?
Yeah, it's in the smokehouse. Yeah. Like,
when,
and it's,
when May comes and she's hiding in the smokehouse and he goes in looking for her.
I think maybe they do it again later in the sequence with all the pipes, but the the handheld camera and that smoke, the where they're smoking all the fish that are caught by the birds, that camera work was so, it's so legit. Like, I mean, I'm gathering, I don't know. I mean, I assume it's a real environment. The actors are there. They're actually shooting it. But the everything like tracking in perfectly, it's just rock solid, and it's lit in a really low lighting kind of way. Again, lots of backlighting, lots of environmental stuff, and the compositing and the lighting in there is just super spectacular with that amazing camera work too.
That was the next thing I was going to bring up, which dovetails into that, is the marriage of live action photography and May/Nova's interaction with the real photography, the rendered photography, and the characters. I was in every scene. I was 100% in. They are there together in that scene. They are interacting. That is actually happening, because I couldn't really find any moments that jumped out at me where I was like, oh, this is a this, that, and the other thing.
So this would be a really good point to, in the discussion, to point out that Eric Winkrest is the visual effects supervisor. He's really good in this. He's also was nominated for a visual effects Oscar at the 87th Academy Awards for Dawn of Planet of the Apes.
Right.
And with Joe Leteri, Dan Lemon, and Daniel Barrett. But Eric does a really, really good job here. But to your point about, I guess that was live action, which it was. We did a interview with both Eric and Wes Ball on FX Guide, and I put the question to them because there was this rumor floating around at the time that they were going to put a version of the film out where they showed the entire live action plate photography against what they finally did, and they completely confirmed that. In fact, Wes is really keen to show this. So refreshing to have a director so enthusiastic about visual effects. And he wants to show that not to be, as some may have guessed, hey, look what we shot in camera. It's more to show, hey, look how well the visual effects team translated what we were shooting in camera to on 100%. Set. This is not a, hey, we did it in camera, we can prove it. This is the exact opposite. But yeah, he's going to have the film shown where half the screen, because it's a scope, it's very, clearly like not 16 by 9, but like wider. It's going to be top of the screen, the actual film, bottom of the screen, what they shot on location, or vice versa. The point is you can track along and see the edit without any visual effects effectively, and then with the visual effects as the final film is put together. And he was really enthusiastic to get that out to audiences, to just let everybody see how well that integration happened. Because I completely agree with you. Like when they're on the bridge, and they're trapped for the first, I think for the first time, all three of them, before they get taken to the encampment at about end of Act Two. Like the sense that they're all three there, it's just no point. Do you think, well, hang on, like those guards can't be there. Those two characters can't be. There's only one human in this shot. Like it's no point.
Right. And what's plate and what's CG and what's, seamless.
There are times when you clearly know that it's CG. You've got a whole lot of eagles catching fish and landing on apes, and you kind of be stupid if you didn't know it was CG. But in those, you just like everything just seems as tangible and as real as everything else. I can't tell you that the water was fake or that the bridge was fake or that the, you know, whatever, because it all just looks so well done.
I got to just say the water and the flooding of the armory. There's a couple moments in there where the water, it really was the one thing that in that sequence where I was like, weird, like what, that does not look right somehow. There's something about it. And I made a couple notes. I thought that there were times where the water flooding, like where we're looking down into the sort of pipe structure and we're seeing all the water coming in and we're seeing somebody struggling to, you know, get their footing or whatever, and they're being, some of them are being swept away, and some of that water. Now, if it's practical water, then okay, whatever. I'm a moron, but it looked like a lot of it was digital water, and it looked small, in terms of the scale, and I kept thinking it looked almost like in parts the water looked like cellophane, rather than water. Like the surface tension of it, it felt too stiff in places. And it's almost as if there were parts of the water that weren't, you know, splashing or aerating, where there was a large surface that looked like it had almost like a single large light on it. So the specular highlight was really big on the water surface, and it wasn't broken up with any additional noise or you know, the kind of breaking of the surface tension of the water. And it just didn't look, and it made it look smaller. It didn't look to the scale that I think it was supposed to look like. That was my read on it anyway, but it was the one thing, and it was only in a couple shots that it looked that way, I think, but it was the one thing that I saw where I was like, you know, compared to everything else that I'm seeing, that kind of just wasn't as
hot. When Noah is pursued into that flooding sequence, that's all CG. Yeah. Like that's because they couldn't flood it. And even if they could flood it, cause that was shot, a lot of the film was shot in Australia, but that, you'll hear it in the podcast if you're listening. Like a lot of those sequences with the water and stuff, the water CG, the characters are CG. There's no point having the pipes not CG. But I guess for me, I had a slightly different problem. Mine wasn't so much that I thought the water looked like cellophane. It's just, and I had this problem in umpteen films lately, including one that we worked on ourselves called Under Paris, where it's just like suddenly you get some water and everything floods. And I'm like, okay, for a start, like where'd all this water come from? Like it seems to me that the water would go to the height of the ocean outside. I don't see why it would keep flooding up and up and up. It's not under pressure. It's not a dam that's busted. It's a, I mean, it's a small dam, right? But it's like a, you know, a relatively modest few meters worth of water. And the water's going to come in, sure. But the thing about water and flooding, and only a few films I think have got this really accurate, is that you don't tend to have a tsunami of water that comes in flooding. You just have, you can't stop it flooding. It's like water just keeps on coming and it rises and it rises and it rises. And for people that have been unfortunate enough to live in flood areas when dams have had to vent water and all that kind of stuff, it's not like you get this tsunami that walks through and just wipes everything out. The water just keeps on rising. And then it just has so much power that it just keeps moving stuff. So for me, it rose too quickly. There was too much of it, but then it was too clean. Like I would have expected in any environment that had been rusty and decayed and everything else like that, that the water would just have been full of debris, full of crap, brown. Very muddy, very sort of brown, not very interesting. And whenever you get water shots like this in movies, someone always wants to go underwater with a shot of somebody not quite having enough oxygen and stuff. And to do that, you have to see them. The only thing worse than that is then you put divers in, which obviously didn't have in this film, and then you stick lights in their head, sort of goggles, so you can, the actors can be seen by the audience, which of course is the worst thing in the world to try and see underwater if you had light shining in your face. But leaving that, which happens in spacecraft as well, leaving that aside for a second, when you go underwater, you want to see the characters kind of struggling, or they've got their foot caught, or they can't reach the gap, or they can't turn off the pump that's going to save the submarine, or whatever it is. The water is always really clear and really well lit, so you can see what's going on. And that's just hard to beat that. I mean, you narratively want that, I understand, but like it just doesn't feel right to me.
I'm gonna say that I agree with you. However, the sequence of Noah, and it's not Proximus Caesar, it's his right-hand guy, right?
Yeah,
when they fight through the pipes.
Yep. His name is Sylva.
Sylvia?
Apparently.
Okay.
Sylvia. He's a Western lowland guerrilla and chief commander of Proximus's army.
Well, when the two of them are under combat in the pipe system while it's flooding, I thought that sequence was incredible. Outside of the water being clear or not, the shot choices, the pacing, it's so hard to do that and follow the action and not feel like, where am I? And I thought they did a really good job of long lens, tight lens, wide lens, you know, just feeling the movement, seeing them being chased and not being confused. And quite frankly, getting some close-ups, they had those red lights and then there were blue lights and they were hitting them and they were wet, which of course is a whole nother process for the CG team and rendering. I was very impressed by that sequence.
I'm following on the heels of my good colleague here, Matt, when he said, this isn't like, we like it. We're just picking at the edges now, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm not saying that this sequence was crap or I hated it.
Well, you weren't talking about the sequence. You're talking a piece of the sequence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, I totally agree with you. Like, it's really good. The whole film's really good. But if we're going to just be picky and arrogant.
No, I mean, that's the point, right?
I would love to hear, like, you know, Eric or any of the folks that worked on the water team, you know, like, am I crazy? Like, what are you talking about? You know, like, are there
if any company in the world should be able to do Wet Apes, it's Weta FX, right? Like, I mean,
well, but we all know from, like, you know, any production, it's like, you know, the clock runs out at a certain point too, and you're doing everything you can to get everything done. And like, there's always those things that, like, you know, I watch this movie and I think, like, it's the effects are so great. It's like the environments are amazing. It's really cool. It's such a well-crafted effects film. But at the same time too, you know, like, when you just thinking back on projects we've all worked on, there's always those things that we remember that, you know, you worked on and you're like, oh man, that was like a last minute, like, could be better shot. We were working really hard to get it to work, and so-and-so was on it and they were so frustrated. And then they finally just were like, okay, fine. We'll go with it. We'll ship it. No one will notice. If they're noticing that, there's, you know, we did something else wrong. Right.
There's only three guys that are going to notice it.
But I think that, you know, it's one of those ones where, like, you know, you always wonder when you see something, if something sticks out to you when you're watching a film as an effects artist, you know, and you're watching any effects movie and you see something and it's like, like, I feel like I've encountered that problem before or I've seen that before. Like,
yeah, but let's
wonder
face it,
if,
like,
that's what they wanted.
And the people, you know, listening to this podcast are, because the people listening to this podcast have a really good visual eye. If you're listening to this podcast, you have an eye and you can see. I've got to say, and to your point, the general population, like, just doesn't have the level of visual fidelity of, and it's not like they don't care. They just don't see it the way we see it. Like, if you listen to
the
podcast,
we can see the threads on the baseball at 90 miles an hour, right?
You know, effectively, like, you know, like, and then you got to ask the question, because, I mean, clearly the film was successful. Clearly the film did a really good job, and it wasn't a mega, mega budget. I mean, it was, you know, good, but really good budget. But I had no sense talking to anyone that it was a rush or that it was, you know, like, done for peanuts. But at some point, I mean, did it make any difference to this film theatrically, critically, or any other way if they'd spent longer on the water? And the answer is probably no.
Of course not. No, not at all.
But yes. So,
I mean, my only nitpick was in the very beginning, to Matt's point, that he pointed out, when they're jumping through the trees and stuff, they're in the wides, in the higher wides, when they're jumping around, there were some, for me, a couple little physics things of, like, I'm because it's the beginning, I'm looking at the characters, I'm like, okay, they're clearly digital, probably the whole thing's digital, the whole shot is digital, I mean, it's gorgeous, but I'm looking at the characters because I want to see how they swing and how they do their things. And there was a couple very minor things where I was like, it just kind of, again, being super picky, not, that didn't ruin the shots for me, but
I was
looking for it.
I was, yeah. I guess kind of like, I don't know, maybe I just was so convinced that Weta was going to nail the apes that I didn't get, but when the eagles appeared, that's when I really started, like, getting my kind of, I'm just going to take myself out of the film for a second and start thinking about these feathers and the grooms and stuff. So, and I thought it was good. And of course, they came back significantly at the end, in the end of the third act. But yeah, I was going to ask you guys, did you feel like the eagles worked? And was it too much of a, well, leave the plot device out for a second, whether you just thought it visually worked.
I liked it as a plot device. I thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. Like, that there's this village of apes that have, you know, learned to, like, you know, do falconry or whatever, right? But they're with eagles and like, getting them to fish and hunt for them and stuff, which is cool. Like, it's a cool idea. Like, why not? Sure, they can ride horses. Like, why can't they also train birds, you know? And there's one shot, I think it's maybe one of the first shots of one of the eagles where it comes in and it's very heroically sort of follow. We track it in.
Oh, at the very early, the opening of the film when we haven't even seen it yet.
Maybe it's the very beginning. Yeah. And it's like, yeah. It comes in and it does its thing where it folds its wings up under. And I thought that one was, it's so shot like to be this great hero moment. But I also thought like, oh, it's great animation. Like it's really cool. And it's so, it's so technically complex watching that thing, kind of fold back in on itself and the way all the feathers splay out and then they come sort of together and you see all that and the anatomy of it really working correctly. And I thought that was really cool. I think
feathers
some
do
of the
present some real technical problems. I mean, feathers are for sure. Not just hair. They are. Yeah.
I just thought it worked pretty good. I mean, I think, there's things that are difficult, I think, to understand because I've never seen a chimpanzee next to an eagle. So there are these scale things that are sort of like, oh, well, yeah, I guess an eagle does have, 6+ foot wingspan.
Eagles are huge. Yeah.
But then like, how big is a chimp? Like, or how, it's like,
how
I'm
big
trying
are these
to,
chimps? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so like the scale, and then I felt like the only other thing, and this, so again, it's like, so, just a vagary in my mind is this memory kind of that I think some of the lighting when we're seeing in broad daylight and we're lighting the apes and the eagle is lit, sometimes they just, because the material properties of the fur, the material properties of the feathers and stuff, and the texture paint, the colors that are applied to the eagle versus sort of the darker hair on the chimp, like sometimes they didn't quite sit in the same space for me, maybe, but
it's like a contrast ratio thing.
Yeah, just when they're on screen together, I think. I don't know.
For broad daylight sequences, not with the eagles, for broad daylight sequences, the attack where they're going for Mae and she escapes, and it's in the trailer when she runs and jumps on the back of the horse. But it's the lead up to that sequence when she's kind of going through the long grass. It's the sort of reminiscent of Jurassic World and the predators going through the grass. But it was, and then there's this open section where the humans are running and getting pulled by nets. And I just thought in broad daylight, that stood up so well.
Like, oh, yeah.
I just really.
And then her running, like her like full out running with a gorilla on horseback, or gorilla, sorry, just running behind her super fast. I mean, we saw part of it in the trailer, like you said, but I at no point was it straining believability, like in the comp, like outside of plot points from a shot design, compositing, rendering, animation standpoint, at no point where you're like, oh, you're like, holy shit. Like, I want to point out it's the sequence when the gorillas come in and set fire to Koa's village. Cause that's, I mean, that's
big wire in that
firelight. Yeah. And then that huge fight up on the, up where his father's, the eagle's nest was
kinda, aviary,
and he goes up there to try and get it, and that's where I guess it's the Sylvia character, he comes into contact with him, right? And they're kind of doing their thing, like that whole sequence again. Of course it comes down to the direction and the shot design before everything else, but after that I thought, again, the camera work makes sense. There's a lot of infrastructure in that tower, similar to the pipes at the end. I never felt lost in the shot choices and the shot design. And then, of course, the lighting in that is maybe the most complex because there's light sources everywhere. And what do? You can't just like blow up the room in orange, right? Like it still has to have drama and shadow and smoke and all that stuff. And it's like, expertly. Yeah.
I feel like that's the thing about a movie like this that is so different in my mind too, is that as an effects project, like you're going to do this film and it's like, oh, it's a really heavy effects film. there's something about it where it's so, I kept thinking it's so kind of in the same zone work-wise as a thing like Avatar, one of the Avatar films, but it's,
sure.
But it's also, I don't know, because it's maybe because it's Earth and it's like, these
it's
are
grounded familiar
creatures. Like it's almost harder in a way. I feel like it's somehow like to create that sense of believability where you feel like you're really immersed in the narrative.
And especially you can really, if you're an Australian and you recognize the Australian bush and you're like,
but I think that speaks to like a level of achievement in it that is, for me, it just was, I mean, again, whatever, I sound like a broken record. I just think it was really, really an impressive feat. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I went somewhere in the movie that I hadn't been in the previous Apes films. Like it felt different.
So just if I can for a moment put a pin in our discussion so I can issue a formal apology from the show. Obviously, Maurice was in the Prelude and was a Bornean orangutan, but not the same as Raka, who was a different Bornean orangutan, who's the one wasn't Maurice that...
Okay.
Far too many years have passed. And also, if you were really watching the show, you'd probably be screaming at your speaker or your headphones right now, going, how could you guys get that so wrong?
I mean, also, I know I'm dumb sometimes, so, you know.
No. I'm just...
I will own the confusion.
I will also say that there are a couple of plot points. Like one is, I always find it funny, like no hero can kill a baddie. A hero can only do actions that cause the baddie to accidentally trip off the ledge and kill themselves or be killed by something else or accidentally fall on the knife. But you can't actually have a hero just go out and kill a baddie, right? Which is why I thought the eagles were so funny at the end. And also, do we really think that Raka, who goes off that bridge when they're trapped into the gushing water, isn't going to come back as a surprise reveal in a second or third film? I mean, that was the most... we all want him to, right? He's just a brilliant character. But whenever in a film you have a character that, quote, dies, but we never see the body and we never see them gasp their final breath and they just disappear off screen somehow. You're like, they're not dead. We know that.
Okay, so to that point, you reminded me of another sequence that made me go, what the fuck, is that bridge sequence when he falls into the water.
Yep.
And first of all, the water and the bridge and the whole thing. But when he falls in the water and he's reaching out to try and grab him and the water's rushing past him and over him and he's wet and it's like, blah, you know, over his face. And I mean, mind blowing. In the theater, I'm looking at my kid and I'm like, what? Like, it's so real.
We are lucky to live in an age when the visual effects are that good.
100%. I mean, the energy and the peril of the scene were diminished by nothing in the film. It was heightened, in fact, because they were able to do shots that were still grounded. Because again, I don't think there's any real impossible camera in this movie. Maybe you could pick a few shots of like an overhead or following a character following or something, which we can do now with drones and other things. So, but like that sequence ending in him in the water and sort of the face before he lets go of like, you know, like you got to let me go kind of thing. Again, to your whole the dumb ape machine gun sequence, the same thing. Like he conveyed a I'm done for but serene kind of, you know, let me go kind of Obi-Wan vibe in with no words. I mean,
the subtle, I think that's a great point, and I think that's the really subtle non-verbal but highly communicative facial animation, like the little eye movements, the sort of looking away and hesitating and then looking back, like, you know, whatever, all those small little bits.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in this film, it just felt like all of the cumulative knowledge from the past Apes films, from the other Avatar films, all the kind of heavy work that Weta has done in this area, like, it just felt like this really, like, oh, now it's, I feel like now we're really seeing it. It's firing on all cylinders here, like in a way that's really impressive.
Which also happens when he meets Raka. That whole sequence when he meets Raka and they're in that, like, you know, whatever it is, like, building that's half broken, and there's I was like the museum or whatever that he was in, and there's light coming through, but it's all organics and all that stuff, and it's like his world, and they're talking, and he stands out because he's orange, and, you know, all that stuff. The way he communicates to Noah and his specific, I always think the orangutans look more real than it. I thought that in the Matt Reeves movies. Yeah. And I think that here, there's something about the face of the orangutan that is more real than the chimps. They've got the face plates
on the side, and the face feels more like flat.
Like it's flatter.
Like more like a human face. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that really sells the orangutans, and I thought this in the previous ones too, is when they, I think it was more recent, was swinging under the Golden Gate Bridge, right? The matting and the sort of almost dreading of some of the longer hairs on the arms and on the, you know, the upper arms and the forearms and stuff. I feel like a lot of that kind of work too, the, just you think of the creature TDs that are working on, you know, getting all that stuff up and running and making it go, like that's so sophisticated work. Like that stuff looks so incredible. And I think that's another way that the orangutans, when they're on screen, like they're so compelling because they have all that additional, almost like, it's almost like they have more clothes on, you know?
It's true.
Fur, you know?
And I think you've hit on the right word, and you've said it a few times. Sophistication is really the term for this film, because it's an action movie. Sure. It's a sci-fi movie in a sense. Sure. But there is a level of sophistication in the movie, even if taking out plot, from a delivery, you know, of effects and filmmaking, that I think is what makes it all work.
Yeah.
Well, in summary, we liked it. In summary, we feel bad about criticizing it, but you know, there you go. The film did go well, as I think I said at the outset. Like, I think at the moment, as the time we're recording this, it's like it's certainly one of the biggest films of this year. It's certainly gone very well. I think I'm going to say 275 million worldwide domestically, and about the year's highest grossing film, which is great. It's also great, not just for Disney and 20th Century Fox, but it's also good for cinemas, right? That people are, you know, going back into the cinemas and seeing stuff, and a good film like this where, you know, okay, you can say it's a franchise, but nevertheless, it's still a good film that people have, you know, put money on the table to go and see, is a good thing for all of us and for the industry generally. So I certainly looking forward to subsequent sequels that'll be coming out. I think the story is nice to be a fresh story. And I think they've set up enough elements in this that it didn't feel like, I think some films, you know, you feel like, well, you're just setting up for the second film. And I kind of felt like I was a bit used, like they didn't give me a film yet. They just gave me the setup for the next one. This wasn't the case. This is fine in its own right. So with that, I'm going to thank you guys so much for listening. And thank you guys so much for hosting. Matt, where can people connect with you if they want to?
I'm at mattwallen.com. Yeah, just all things me located there.
And Jason, you're going to say all things Diamond, but I was watching the Jim Henson documentary, which is spectacular. Mm-hmm. Knowing your work with the Muppets, I saw like there was a Diamond production or something in the credits, and it wasn't you, I don't think. But I leapt out of my chair going, is that Jason? He just didn't tell me. And then I had to back up the film and try and find where this one that I got on the internet and searched it, and I discovered it was just somebody else using one word Diamond in their production company name.
How dare they?
That take is nothing a great away from those documentary.
It is a very good documentary.
Yeah, I need to watch it.
Yeah, it's though you feel like you could have a longer one, don't you? Like you're watching that documentary, you're
sure.
This could go longer. This could.
You could watch I could watch the puppeteers or Muppeteers all day. Like it's magic.
Anyway, so where can people find Jason Diamond as opposed to those that are rudely using the word Diamond in their name?
I'm also going to say that I realize that WEDA stands for Wet Apes.
Okay.
W-E-T-A.
It doesn't, but it's actually...
does now.
It's It's actually it a native now. Bug in New Zealand.
But no, yeah, I know. Sure.
Okay.
I know. I'm
an actual wetter.
Being hyperbolic about wet apes. Yes, thediamondbros.com and Jason Diamond, one word, because there are other Jason Diamonds, and while I love them just as much as they can be loved, there's I am me, they are them.
Okay. Thank you guys so much for listening and being part of our little inner circle of people that really care about the little sort of hairs coming off the baseball being thrown at 90 miles an hour like we do. We appreciate your support as always. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.